Because I still love Zen, you know, and miss it to a certain extent. And I think for me, the two mix together because, you know, Tibetan Buddhism has this kind of philosophy, this like deep philosophical school and tradition. And we're from the Sakya lineage, which is all, you know, around logic and epistemology and things like that. And so... so it's got that, and while Zen, for the most part, doesn't have that kind of rich tradition of philosophy, mostly because it's trying to get you out of that frame of mind, right? And so it's any way necessary, whether it's by just long, drawn-out sitting or some kind of lightning bolt of, you know, Satori that hits you whenever you're, wherever you're at, you know? And so it's sort of like, so I think, so that has that, but then, you know, Zen for me just has this really kind of, I don't know, this quality of like, nothing is special, you know, like just whatever you think you're doing, just cut it out, you know, just right here, right now, what you're doing, but whatever you're doing in that way, do it well, do it in a precise way, you know? And so for me, like this OCD part of me where I like to keep my shit really organized, Zen is great. Everything is so clean. You know what I mean? And when I want to make things really too complex in my head, you can't do that. You're just simple, you know? You just sit or you just do what you're doing. And then that's the path. And so there's something about it that I think both aligned with my just natural tendencies, but also challenged me a lot, you know, to get out of my head, to get out of the kind of philosophical, you know, transcendental, like spiritual stuff, and just really kind of be in the here and now, you know. And I think for me too, I you know, have always been a practitioner of, like I mentioned before, of like traditional Japanese or Okinawan martial arts. And so those, that has so much to share, if you will, with Zen in this way of, you know, like you can be in this whirlwind of motion or chaos, either physically with things happening around you, and then with martial arts, you're able to kind of center and ground and be like, no matter what's happening around me, I can be still and fine. And when I do move, it's with clarity and purpose, you know, in some way. And I think the same for Zen, like kind of in your own head, you know, or in your own emotions. I find this kind of stillness and clarity with Zen. So I miss Zen a lot, but I think for me... the Tibetan Buddhist stuff, it just has so many different ways of talking about emptiness or attachment or interdependence or, you know, shempa or emotions. It just has so many angles to look at the same thing that it's like... you hear the same teaching over and over again, but it's always new to me. And so that's what I really appreciate about, you know, about Tibetan Buddhism. For me, I've had a hard time jumping to, you know, kind of the Vajrayana part of Buddhism. A lot of those esoteric Vajrayana kind of visualization sorts of practices. You know, I'm kind of a skeptic and a pessimist, you know, so I'm doing it and just like, what am I? Are you kidding me? More skull cups and brains and blood and, you know, light. There's so much light. Like, why is there all this light oozing all over me? You know, like, it's just too much, you know.
And when, nectar. Don't forget about the nectar.
It's all the nectar. Yeah. Nectar in my head, my pores and everything, you know, and discs, like moon discs and all that stuff. And it's just like, whoa, that's, you know, like... So I get intellectually what it's for, but somehow for me, you know, an hour of shamatha is just as, like, you know, profound for me. Like, I just wonder, I just don't know if I'm at this Vajrayana level of practice. And, you know, from my understanding of the tradition, like, that Vajrayana stuff was held for very established, you know, monks and nuns who have been practitioners forever and ever, you know. And now suddenly it came to the West and all of a sudden it's out there everywhere. I'll never forget going with our teacher, Jam Young. I was at Costco. We're at Costco. And Jam Young will use Costco as a metaphor in Buddhist teachings all the time. It's hilarious. The guy's hilarious. But so we were at Costco and we're in the book section and we saw this huge book of all these Tibetan deities. And so, and we have it actually upstairs. Mm-hmm. And so you open it up and there's these beautiful, giant page, colorful, you know, imagery of Vajrayana practice, like Vajrayogini or, you know, all these other kinds of ones. And it's sort of like we were turning the page and I looked over at him and he looked a little dazed as he's looking at it. And I was like, well, isn't this cool, Jam Young? Don't you think this is cool? And we turned to like Vajrayogini, for example, and he looked at me and said, this tanka, you know, of this image in the Gompa, it's always covered. You can't see it as a monk unless you have the initiation and you're ready to practice it. And he said, that's after like 30 years of, you know, like concerted practice. So here, like a generation ago, you spend 30 years of your life getting ready to see this image in this beautiful ritual. And now, 30 years later, it's in some giant book in Costco, you know, next to a cookbook and something by Rachel Ray and something, you know, who knows, like Thomas Jefferson or something. So it's just like, you know, it's wild how this goes. And so a lot of times I think, I just want to really be careful. Am I intellectually or culturally appropriating something? Are we actually like colonizing something? Even though I think the Tibetans are open about it, I don't know if that's enough for us to think it's okay to just take it and do what we will with it, when we're not oriented to where it came from and what the purpose of it in the beginning is, you know? So I think that's where, like, our teacher, Jam Young, he just very recently, with his holiness, the 43rd Sakya Treason coming, he only just recently switched to doing a Vajrayana practice. He would, you know, like, Western students would come and want the nectar and the skull cups and all that stuff. And he was like, let's just shamatha vipassana it, you know, like that's probably good enough. And so, you know, I think when you talk about earlier, you were talking about like the financial feasibility of a sangha, or like, how is it different here than there? I think of like, you know, it's like these collectivist societies versus these individualistic societies. And so many of us come to Buddhism because it's like a individual project, you know, where it's sort of very similar, I think, to Christian tradition. Like, something's wrong with me, I need to go somewhere to fix it, you know. And then you go to Buddhism and Buddhism's like, there's really nothing to fix, you know. We're all broken and that's cool and whatever, you know. And so then it's like you just get a bunch of individual projects in one same room together. And the only binding force is usually the teacher, you know, to hold the space and figure out the practice. But it's seldom like then the Sangha comes together and focuses on something else, some social justice effort or, you know, evangelizing or something like that. So it's definitely a different cultural monster, I think.
Yeah. And I'd say, you know, when we talk about the differences between, you know, why Tibetan Buddhism feels more like home versus maybe my first experiences with Zen Buddhism, Jude, through martial arts, loves the organization and the discipline. You know, there's a lot of discipline in Zen, and I think specifically the Japanese martial arts, Zen Buddhism, whereas in Tibetan Buddhism, it feels like it's more just like one crazy family. You know, it's like you go to Thanksgiving dinner and your uncle is over there, you know, he's engaged in some conversation, there's kids running around, you know, there's noise, and it's more like real life, you know. To me, I think Tibetan Buddhism feels like more like real life, even though there is the strong contemplative and there is a discipline, you know, to it as well. But it doesn't take itself so seriously, I think, for me. I think when we were at the San Francisco Zen Center, you know, about that thing about nothing being special, I think there's a part of us as human beings that really likes relationships, you know? And so if nothing's special, there's really no need to create a bond or a relationship with another person, you know? You can kind of just be an island in and of, you know, of yourself. And so I remember like being there. What I really appreciated about Zen is it taught me how to sit. I like the discipline of learning how to sit in the Zen tradition because I feel like it served me well, throughout my meditative practice. But as far as, the culture of Zen and the feeling, the vibe that you get, it's a little bit too disciplined for me, and maybe a little bit too, I don't know how to say it, but you know, I heard one Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Ani Sering, she's actually American, but she's a nun. And she said, you know, even bodhisattvas have to balance their checkbook. You know, like if you can't come back into and re-enter, you know, the real world and kind of do the things that you need to do, I think maybe it creates even more dissonance. So I think with Tibetan Buddhism, it's very portable. And even though there's this whole bureaucracy, so to speak, with monks and a lot of the support that goes from like the bottom up and that type of thing. It just feels like it always comes back to, you know, being out in the open at some point. You know, so I think that part's always spoken to me, as well as just being able to connect with whichever Buddhist teacher that happens to be there. I'd have to say there are some teachers that seem so advanced. Like my first interactions with Sakya Treason when we went to take an empowerment from him in Spain was that he is just practicing nonstop. I mean, there's never a time that he's not practicing, but he's eating lunch and he's doing this and he's doing that, you know, he's interacting with his wife and his sons and, but he's always practicing. And there's something about that feels impenetrable, but at the same time, it was my first direct experience of what having a guru would be like, is that I'm just projecting everything up onto this individual, you know, who knows what's actually going on for him. I don't know, you know, but I'm projecting all these things onto him. And really, it's just reflecting back my own capability, you know, my own untapped potential. And I think that was just, and there's something about that inaccessibility and the fact that they seem so spiritual is that that's exactly what's called for us to have that direct experience of this projection that we do with them, you know, because if they had more of a personality or more individualism, it would be difficult, you know, but when they're up there and they're just all practice all the time, 24/7, it's like, that's what really can, you know, reflect back to you, you know, your potential, I think. So I think that for me, that's the difference between why I connected with Tibetan Buddhism versus Zen, is that it feels more accessible. It feels more out in the open. It feels like, you know, I probably shouldn't, you know, eat a greasy hamburger while I'm practicing, but you might, you know, I mean, it's a possibility. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.